Good morning and welcome to the Talking Information Center. Today is Sunday, August 23rd, and we have today's reading of the Boston Herald being read to you by William. Good morning, William.
Good morning, Billy, and good morning, listeners, to the Talking Information Center's reading of the Boston Sunday Herald for August 23rd of 2026. We begin with a story by Tim Dunn and Gayla Cawley. Election Primer, a look at the key races in the 2026 September primary. Massachusetts voters will decide on several races in a highly anticipated primary election on September 1st. Massachusetts voters prepare to decide on several key races in the September 1st primary election, from the Republican gubernatorial race and a clash for the U.S. Senate to a key race for seats on Beacon Hill and battles for district attorney in Suffolk County and beyond. Here's what voters need to know. The Republican gubernatorial race, Minot and Shortsleeve. On the Republican ballot, Massachusetts voters will have a chance to decide who takes on Governor Maura Healey in the general election in November, Mike Minot or Brian Shortsleeve. Minot, a billionaire and first-time political candidate, brings a wealth of experience from the private sector, who for nearly two decades led the medical technology company AmbioMed, acquired by Johnson & Johnson back in 2022. Shortsleeve served as the chief administrator and later an acting general manager of the MBTA under former Governor Charlie Baker. He calls himself a turnaround specialist in campaign materials from his experience improving the agency. Both candidates served in the U.S. military. Shortsleeve served in the Marine Corps and Minot as an Army Airborne Ranger and West Point graduate. Minot has hung his hat on that landslide victory he captured at the Massachusetts Republican Convention, taking home 70% of the votes from the delegates. Shortsleeve made the ballot by a hair, just squeezing by the 15% delegate vote threshold. Minot has ignored requests from the Shortsleeve campaign to participate in primary debates and has focused on taking on Healey in the general election. On the other hand, Shortsleeve has centered his campaign around the attacks both Healey and Minot, which has earned him some criticism from fellow Republicans. Two candidates share many ideas about the Commonwealth's future, but the abortion issue may be what separates them most. Shortsleeve is pro-choice, while Minot says he is pro-life. The abortion issue has regained importance in deep blue Massachusetts after Democrat Governor Healey this month signed into law a controversial bill that removes all restrictions on abortions after 24 weeks of gestation. U.S. Senate Markey versus Moulton. The Democrat primary race between Senator Ed Markey and Congressman Seth Moulton is less separated by political vision than by something else. Age. Moulton has centered his campaign around promoting himself as a fresh face Capitol Hill needs to replace the aging establishment. A group epitomized by Markey, who has served in Congress for 50 years. He was first elected to the U.S. Senate back in 1976, 2 years before Moulton was born. Markey has continued this by highlighting the need for someone with his experience in Washington while also pushing his record of fighting for the liberal Democrat values during his lengthy tenure. With real political differences between the two, Markey and Moulton have resorted to mudslinging. They have exchanged accusations of insider trading and accepting campaign donations from corporate PACs. They've also rallied against President Trump, with Markey and Moulton mentioning the president frequently during their three summertime debates. Markey has remained a frontrunner in the race, according to polls, starting with a sizable 19-point lead over Moulton in the polls taken back in November. Moulton has considerably closed the gap over the spring and summer months, but a recent UMass Amherst WCVB poll gave Markey a massive 30-point advantage in August. The primary winner will face Republican candidate John Deaton in the general election. The 8th Congressional District, Lynch versus Roth. Longtime Congressman Stephen Lynch is facing a primary challenge from Democrat candidate Patrick Roth. Lynch was first elected in 2001, replacing outgoing former Congressman Joe Moakley. He has held various House committee assignments during his tenure, currently serving as a ranking member of the House Oversight Committee. Lynch's campaign paints him as a proven, experienced, common-sense candidate that will stand up to Republicans and President Trump. Like Senator Markey, the 71-year-old Lynch is fending off attacks from both on his age and his 25-year stay on Capitol Hill. The younger Rolfe, who is 39, is promoting himself as voting rights advocate and attorney, who will serve as a younger, fresher face to take on President Trump's authoritarian agenda and deliver bold solutions for working people. Rolfe also boasts his resume, which includes serving as an aide to former Governor Deval Patrick and former President Barack Hussein Obama. "I'm running against a member of Congress who's been an elected official since I was 5 years old," Rolfe told CNN News Center last month. "Isn't it time for the next generation to get someone new in there to do something a little different and that's more tailored to what the times require?" Lynch has countered these attacks with highlighting Rolfe's Connecticut upbringing, as well as his political support for private equity groups in the pharmaceutical industry. First Congressional District, Neal versus Whalen. Voters in Massachusetts will face a similar situation in the First Congressional District, an aging Democratic incumbent trying to hold on to his seat from a younger, more progressive challenger. Longtime Congressman Richard Neal is running to defend his seat against 39-year-old high school teacher Jerome Whalen. Neal, who paints himself as a lunch bucket Democrat, was first elected in Congress in 1989 after serving as Springfield mayor for 5 years prior to that. Currently, the 77-year-old Neal serves as a ranking member of the House Ways and Means Committee, which he chaired until 2023. Whalen holds both a bachelor's degree and a Ph.D. from UMass Amherst, degrees he earned in 2011 and 2018, respectively. He has worked as a high school teacher and for a non-profit local community media outlet. In addition to going after Neal's age and over 35 years in Congress, Whalen has zeroed in on Neal's acceptance of campaign donations from corporate PACs. Whalen promotes himself as an everyman candidate who will provide a fresh start and more progressive perspective on Capitol Hill, particularly highlighting his support for Medicare for All. Neal is opposed to that. Neal is fending off attacks on his age and lengthy tenure by promoting the need for his vast wealth of political experience and representation of Western Massachusetts. Otherwise, Neal has adopted a classic incumbent playbook by not mentioning Whalen's name or responding to any attacks launched by him. Neal and Whalen will participate in a televised debate next week on WWLP-TV. State Senate, 1st Suffolk District, Collins versus Gale. Mayor Michelle Wu's failed push to increase commercial tax rates has taken center stage in a state Senate race between incumbent Nick Collins and his challenger, LaToya Gale. Collins, a South Boston Democrat, led the effort to kill Wu's tax shift bill in the Senate 2 years ago. Wu, in turn, went on the offensive this year and campaigned fiercely against him by endorsing his primary opponent and lobbyist, Gale. The race has escalated a years-long public feud between Wu and Collins, with the two trading jabs over what Wu has characterized as Collins' move to block Boston homeowners from seeing a tax break through her stalled legislation. Wu's bill, which Gale supports, would have shifted more of the city's property tax burden from homeowners to commercial property owners for several years. Collins last month undercut Wu on the matter by tucking a property tax relief clause into the state's economic development bill to blunt what he called Boston's unnecessary tax increase on homeowners. His alternative tax relief clause was passed unanimously by the state Senate, leading Mayor Wu to slam Collins for being an obstacle, not a partner, on tax relief. Gale, a political newcomer, is vying to unseat Collins. He was first elected to public office in 2010 to the House of Representatives and has last held the 1st Suffolk Senate seat in 2018. State Senate, Suffolk and Middlesex, Brownsberger versus Lander. It's the battle of the Boston mayors in the race between political newcomers Daniel Lander and State Senate President pro tempore William Brownsberger. A Wu's influence beyond the city will be tested in this race. Wu is backing Lander, a former senior aide in her administration, in his bid to unseat Brownsberger, who co-led the push to kill her signature tax bill in the Senate in late 2024. In a shot at Wu, former Mayor Marty Walsh has endorsed Brownsberger, who is also backed by Governor Healey and Attorney General Andrea Campbell. Landers, who supported Wu's tax bill, has touted an endorsement from U.S. Senator Elizabeth Warren, a mentor of Wu. He worked as a senior political advisor for Warren in the 2020 presidential campaign. Landis has cast the race as trying to change the broken status quo of Beacon Hill by trying to oust Brownsberger, whom he calls its architect. Brownsberger is leading his first challenge since winning his Senate seat in 2011 special election. He has touted his experience and has praised for his ability to work with other legislators to get things done, as Walsh put it. Brownsberger, a Belmont Democrat, represents neighborhoods beyond the hub. His Suffolk and Middlesex district seat includes Watertown, Belmont, as well as Fenway and Alston, Brighton neighborhoods of Boston and West Cambridge. Suffolk District Attorney Hayden versus Rollins versus Champion. A nasty Suffolk District Attorney's race simmers in the longstanding vitriol between incumbent Kevin Hayden and his predecessor, Rachel Rollins. A third candidate, Linda Champion, has sought to cast herself as a steady alternative. Hayden and Rollins took swipes at each other over their past ethics lapses at a rowdy debate in Roxbury earlier this month. Rollins resigned in disgrace from her post as the Massachusetts U.S. Attorney in May of 2023, amid a federal ethics probe that found she abused her position by leaking confidential information that was damaging to Hayden and lying about it to federal investigators. Two damning federal watchdog reports found that Rollins leaked confidential Department of Justice information during her time as U.S. attorney in an effort to influence the Suffolk DA's race in favor of her preferred successor and fellow progressive, ex-Boston City Councilor Ricardo Arroyo. Hayden won the 2022 Democrat primary over Arroyo and ran unopposed in the general election that year. He is seeking a second four-year term. Rollins claimed during the debate that she resigned as the U.S. attorney not because of the federal ethics probe, but because she was receiving death threats, calling herself a crime victim. She called the findings of the federal probe allegations, while pointing to a 2024 state ethics violation Hayden was hit with related to that same primary race with Arroyo, for which he paid a $5,000 fine. Rollins has a different scandal this time around amid her bid to reclaim her old job as the Suffolk DA. Suspicious signatures out of Chelsea were flagged on Rollins' nomination papers, a matter Rollins says she's looking into, and A.G. Campbell said should lead to her removal from the ballot if she fraudulently got on the ballot. Hayden has been slammed by Boston Police Patrolmen's Association over his decision to charge a city cop with manslaughter following a fatal police shooting of a carjacking suspect. The BPPA has endorsed Champion, a prosecutor who ran unsuccessfully for Suffolk DA in 2018, the race Rollins won. The DA has also been criticized by community and elected leaders for choosing not to release the related police body camera footage before the homicide trial. Champion said during the debate that both of her opponents are unfit for office. End of article. In our next article, meet the Andover Chinese national who allegedly voted illegally in Massachusetts. What the Democrats always tell us can never happen just happened again. A non-citizen has been arrested and charged with voting in a U.S. presidential election, Stop me if you've heard this before. This time, it's a sinister Chinese grifter named Yupeng Sun, age 33, who has lately been flopping in Andover. That's the bad news. The good news is that at least Mr. Sun doesn't seem to have stolen $404,000 in welfare benefits, unlike the Colombian illegal convicted last winter after living large on the Massachusetts taxpayer's dime. That felon would be Lena Maria Orova-Hernandez, who was sentenced to 33 months. You may recall that she was recorded on surveillance video on Election Day 2024, sporting an I Voted sticker. Wonder what that thieving third world cast her ballot for. The charges against Yupeng Sun were brought by the feds because Democrats in Massachusetts now basically refuse to arrest any non-citizen, legal or illegal, for anything professional courtesy, you know. On my radio show Friday, I asked U.S. Attorney Leah Foley if the arresting ICE officer had asked Sun who he voted for in the 2024 presidential election. "I'm not sure," she said. "I don't even know if he was asked, but that's not even the point. The point is they shouldn't have the opportunity to vote if they're not citizens." I get it. But it's still a question all us taxpayers would like answered, even if we have a pretty good idea which party a foreign criminal is going to be naturally attracted to, if only for purposes of self-preservation. Republicans expect everybody to work. Democrats, not so much. The larger point of this kind of fraud by foreigners is how easy it is, because in America, you can scam. In every part of life, the whole U.S. system is or was based on trust. Traditionally, Americans verify that they are who they are and that they are saying what they are saying is truthful. It worked when only Americans and foreigners who wanted to become Americans lived in America. Then the Democrats imported 30 or 40 million freeloading foreigners, most of them illegal, and the whole society began to unravel, especially when, unlike Americans, the foreigners are not held responsible for any crimes they commit, at least in the blue states. In Massachusetts, there are no checks and balances for voting, Foley said. No guardrails to ensure the integrity of our elections. Under current Massachusetts state law, there is no verification of identity or citizenship. And that's just the way the Democrats want it. On Thursday night, 80-year-old Senator Ed Markey claimed the Republicans want to steal the midterms. They would do this, apparently, by requiring voter ID, the way you need an ID to buy a beer at Fenway Park or to board a commercial airliner. Approximately 80% of the population support honest elections, including more than 70% of Democrats. So what? Democrat politicians do not care. Laws? They don't need no stinking laws. They're Democrats. You want to know how easy it is for a foreigner to fraudulently register to vote? Yupeng Sun is Exhibit A. According to the complaint, he had a beef with his landlords, who were also Chinese nationals. He ended up getting arrested. He decided to take revenge on them, so he registered his landlord to illegally vote through the foolproof online state portal. He's 33, Foley said, and he's quite easily impersonated a 70-year-old man. No one ever asked him to prove his citizenship or ask him any questions whatsoever. In their affidavit, ICE agents quote Sun's pidgin English answers to some of their questions when he was lugged recently. He demonstrated a Mayor de Pena-like proficiency in the English language. Asked if he had forged his victim's signature, Sun replied, "I? Signature?" Asked how his landlord victim had treated him, Sun said, "They treat me as not good." "What exactly did they do to you?" the G-man asked. "Sub-landlord abused me." So Sun is at least assimilated enough to claim he's a victim. That's the first scam they all figure out, even before heading to the welfare office. Leah Foley is originally from Louisiana, which is still part of America. Election cheating is discouraged, more than somewhat. But Foley says when she votes in Massachusetts and tries to present an ID, they say, put that away, like I've pulled out a gun instead of a driver's license. I know what she means. I vote in Florida now. I love it when the poll workers, who in my country work for a Democrat politician, ask me for both my license and my voter ID card. It's the third biggest state in the country, and we have all the returns by 10 o'clock because everything is on the level. Perhaps you've noticed that Democrats have never won anything in Florida since the cheating was stopped. Is that a coincidence? Whenever you mention illegals registering and voting, even if it's by the thousands, as in New Jersey, regime-controlled media always says the stories are debunked or totally unfounded. If they can't deny every crime, they can't just antidote or one-off it. Well, said Foley, so far here are three cases, so it's three off and more are coming. But it's not about changing the returns. It's about ensuring the integrity of our elections. If Yu Ping's son hadn't been so bold as to allegedly turn in his elderly landlord to try to frame him, we would never have known how Kamala Harris got one of her votes in Massachusetts. By the way, the fraudulent ballot was cast in the city of Malden, where Senator Markey used to live a half a century ago. Election fraud in Malden? Say it ain't so. But that's the way Ed Markey likes it. They didn't use him to call a landslide. They didn't used to call him Landslide Eddie for nothing, you know. And you can pre-order Howie Carr's book, Mass Corruption, Volume 2, The Text and More, at HowieCarrShow.com. This next piece is by Joe Battenfeld. Will pollsters be wrong again on primary day in Massachusetts? Massachusetts will be the primary testing ground soon for whether pollsters who have overestimated the far-left vote continue their downward slide. Pollsters in Wisconsin and Michigan recently failed miserably at predicting the outcome of gubernatorial and Senate races where the progressive candidate's support was vastly overstated. Wisconsin state lawmaker Francesca Hong, a socialist who had called for canceling Thanksgiving, lost to her moderate opponent David Crowley despite polls showing her with a double-digit lead in the race for governor. In Michigan, left-wing Senate candidate Abdul El Sayed barely edged out his opponent by less than a percentage point after primary polls showed him winning easily. In Massachusetts, two new polls show liberal U.S. Senator Ed Markey, who has been endorsed by socialist Bernie Sanders, crushing Democrat opponent Seth Moulton by a wide margin leading up to September's first primary. A Suffolk University Boston Globe poll had Markey up 52% to 38%. So the race is over, right? Markey has successfully locked up the race, Suffolk University pollster David Paleologus said. Paleologus will soon find out whether he will regret that brash prediction. A recent UMass Amherst poll showed Markey winning by an even bigger margin, about 30 points. Markey is banking on young, far-left voters turning out for the expected low-turnout primary on September 1st, when many voters are still in summer vacation mode. They are the type of voters who often don't show up on primary or election day. These are the same type of voters who backed El Sayed in Michigan and Hong in Wisconsin and didn't deliver on primary day, and pollsters there got it wrong big time. It turned out that more moderate, late-deciding voters in Wisconsin pushed Crowley, who had actually dropped out of the race early on, over the finish line. Late-deciding voters in Michigan who are more moderate similarly flocked to El Sayed's opponent, nearly pulling off a huge upset at the extreme far-left socialists. The results of those two states come after pollsters failed to predict Donald Trump's depth of support in 2024 and 2016 presidential races. So what is happening exactly? Are liberal pollsters letting their personal bias get in the way of accurately predicting the race? Are voters just embarrassed to say they will vote for Trump and end up lying to pollsters? Or are polls fundamentally flawed because of so-called non-response bias, where some voters are much more eager to respond to pollsters? Are polls now just completely unreliable? One thing is clear, polls are just a snapshot of the race and cannot predict a late surge for one candidate. That is what seems to have happened in Wisconsin and Michigan. But it's also possible that pollsters who are most likely liberal Democrats are vastly overestimating how many progressive voters end up going to the polls. We'll soon see in Massachusetts whether pollsters will be celebrating or offering excuses for why they screwed up. This next article is from Peter Lucas. Attorney General Campbell has a GOP opponent. And that is good. He may not have a chance, but he's a start. Given her way, Attorney General Andrea Campbell would prefer winning re-election by acclamation rather than facing an opponent. But things do not always work that way. Despite her whining, Campbell is forced to deal with the reality that she has a Republican opponent in November. He is Michael Walsh, a conservative lawyer from Linfield, who Campbell insists should not even be on the ballot, even though the Supreme Judicial Court ruled that he should. Despite the court ruling, which stemmed from a signature-gathering controversy, Campbell said Walsh broke the law to get on the ballot. If so, then Campbell, as the state's chief law enforcement officer, should arrest him. But as everybody knows, Campbell does not arrest anybody, especially illegal criminal immigrants. In fact, she and Governor Healey go out of their way to protect them and have turned Massachusetts into a sanctuary state. Campbell has no respect for the law, Walsh said. Walsh, little known outside the conservative Republican circles, has little or no chance of defeating Campbell in a heavily progressive and Democrat Massachusetts. But he could point out how Campbell has turned the once politically independent office into a taxpayer-funded arm of the Democrat Party, following Healey's footsteps. Campbell has used the office to sue President Donald Trump 60 times, seeking to break Healey's record of suing President Trump 100 times in his first term when she was Attorney General. Many of the suits are generated by the Democrat Attorney General's Association, and Campbell and other Democrat Attorneys General merely sign on. On the state level, Campbell, who bills herself as a people's lawyer, has turned herself into a politician's lawyer, rather than riding herd over the executive and legislative branches of the government run by fellow Democrats. Campbell protects and defends them. Which Walsh will go after Campbell on if he can get her in a debate? He will also press Campbell, among other things, for obstructing the voter-approved audit of the Democrat-controlled legislature that state Auditor Diana DeSoglio has championed. In turn, the legislature rewarded Campbell back in approving lavish increases in her budget. The governor and the legislative leaders are also grateful to Campbell for filing a badly worded proposed ballot question that the SJC rejected, which would have reduced the state income tax from 5% to 4%. Like the audit of the legislature, it would have been approved by the voters if it appeared on the ballot. The question Walsh will ask if whether Campbell filed the badly worded question on purpose or through her incompetence. Also in question is Campbell's defense of a Healey-awarded, smelly $2 billion state building contract in Springfield, partly to form a co-owned by Conan Harris, the husband of U.S. Representative Ayanna Pressley of Boston. Pressley, who has become a millionaire while in office, talks like a socialist but invests like a capitalist. She now has a net worth of $8 million. Campbell served with her buddy Presley when both were members of the Boston City Council. Rather to investigate the awarding of the contract by the states, as attorneys general would have done in the past, Campbell attacked the challengers who were contesting the matter in court. She said their complaint was nothing more than a fever dream of imagined malfeasance. Maybe so. But the debate with Walsh would go a long way to clear the air. Campbell owes the public at least that. And that was Peter Lucas. In today's editorial, Mayor Wu's train is coming for property owners leasing to ICE, by the editorial board of the Herald. In what version of America is it okay for a city mayor to Freedom of Information Act the addresses of private citizens legally leasing their property to a government agency in order to reach out to those property owners to tell them that they disapprove of their choice of tenant because their views don't align? The Boston version, apparently, U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement posted on a government procurement site that the agency was conducting a market research to identify sources capable of providing surface and/or structured vehicle parking spaces in the vicinity of existing or planned ICE facilities in cities across the country. That's government speak for, we need parking. Boston's on the list, and I said it was looking for 249 contiguous spaces. ICE is persona non grata here, and Mayor Michelle Wu signed an executive order to prevent ICE from operating on city property, parks, or parking lots without a court order or a warrant. It makes sense that the agency would try to lease space from private owners. And while Mayor Wu, Democrat, admitted in an interview with WCVB on the record Sunday that she can't stop private property owners from leasing to ICE, that isn't slam the brakes on the Wu train. She said her office will file public records requests to learn who's interested in working with the agency so that the city can contact those entities. We can't block private property owners, she said, but the city can inform them that their opinion on the issues, which is that this is not a way to make the community safer. There's a lot to unpack here. First, the property owners are doing nothing illegal. Neither is ICE in seeking to rent spaces from them. Second, the mayor admits the city can't block the private property owners. So what's the point? The point is to let them know the mayor isn't happy with them, as in, what you're doing is legal, but according to us, it's out of line. And what property owners want to be on the bad side of Mayor Wu. But what if the property owners genuinely don't agree that this is not a way to make the community safer? What if they read of the arrest of Martin Carius Reyes, a criminal illegal immigrant living in Boston? ERO Boston tweeted of Reyes' arrest, noting that the illegal immigrant from Honduras had a criminal history that includes pending charges for statutory rape and prior arrests for rape of a child and indecent assault and battery on a child under 14. Getting criminal illegal immigrants off our streets is definitely a way to make the community safer. Reyes is hardly ERO's first such caller, as it and ICE are large, have arrested illegal immigrants on drug trafficking, rape, child rape, murder, and assault charges. The agency also listed recent arrests of illegal immigrants in Everett, Waltham, Framingham, Worcester, Rhode Island, and Maine on the next post. That apparently is inconsequential in these parts. Will property owners be cowed by a call from City Hall? Or will they resist, a popular term on the left, as long as the administration being resisted is Donald Trump's? Filing FOIAs on property owners to address their leasing spaces to ICE is Big Brother in no King's T-shirt. In our next article, Ayanna Pressley speaks on the murder at her Boston home, defends a $2 billion state contract awarded to her husband's firm by Tim Dunn. Congresswoman Ayanna Pressley has opened up about the homicide at a Boston home she owned or was owned by her husband and defended the $2 billion state contract his company was awarded. Pressley answered the Herald's question on the hot-button issues of the homicide, which is under investigation, and the contract on the Springfield Judicial Center that is subject to a lawsuit following a campaign event for Senator Edward Markey at Roxbury Community College. Pressley defends husband on $2 billion state contract. Pressley jumped to the defense of her husband, Connor Ann Harris, when asked by the Herald if the $2 billion state contract awarded by the Massachusetts Division of Capital Asset Management and Maintenance, DCAM, to a partnership that includes his Boston-based firm, Kojo Partners, was fair and appropriate. Harris co-owns that partnership with Massachusetts Convention Center Authority Interim Executive Director John Barrows, who has since divested his interest in it. The congresswoman distanced herself from her husband's finances, adding that she is proud of Harris. I don't have any unique insights on that. My husband and I met later in life. We got married later in life. We keep our finances and everything completely separate, Pressley said. What I will say is that I've always been proud of my husband and what he has done. He is the American dream. He's overcome a great deal. He's made a great contribution to society. The contract awarded to the partnership that includes Kojo Partners, called Liberty Junction, is facing a lawsuit to stop it in its tracks by two of the 10 losing bidders, New England used car magnate Jeb Belice and real estate conglomerate Dinesh Patel, who filed the suit on July 9th under their respective business entities, USPB JV LLC and Tower Square LLC. The legal battle over the contract comes amid a backlash that such a lucrative contract was awarded to a company owned by two men with notable political connections and possible conflicts of interest. Attorney General Andrea Campbell's office is defending DCAM and the civil suit. The office filed a scathing response earlier this month, calling the suit nothing more than a fever dream of imagined malfeasance. The Massachusetts Fiscal Alliance says Pressley's stated ignorance of the Springfield contract only raises more red flags over the deal. If the contract was won by a mediocrity, it shouldn't be hard for the congresswoman to explain why saying "I don't know" over and over is doing nothing to help her family's defense. Mass Fiscal Executive Director Paul Craney told the Herald, DCAM announced the contract was awarded to Liberty Junction in a July 2nd press release, the last business day before the Independence Day weekend. The agency maintained it awarded the contract based on recommendations by the Massachusetts trial court in an effort to finish the project as quickly as possible. Governor Maura Healey has defended the contract, saying it is the best deal for taxpayers, or something disputed by another losing bidder. The two Republican candidates for governor are also slamming Pressley, with Brian Shortsleeve and Mike Minogue both blasting the appearance of corruption in Massachusetts politics, something they say Healey is complicit in. The first rule of Massachusetts politics is the insiders win. The proposed $2 billion Springfield courthouse is what happens when political insiders make the deals and hardworking taxpayers foot the bill, said Mike Minogue. As governor, I'll fight to stop insider deals and bring transparency and accountability back to the Commonwealth. Massachusetts is working for some, but not all. This $2 billion deal is proof that Governor Maura Healey is failing us. When Ayanna Pressley was confronted on her husband's shady business deals with Maura Healey, even she distanced herself from the scandal, added Shortsleeve. Our state is plagued with corruption. We need to overhaul top to bottom, and I look forward to delivering that. Ayanna Pressley's net worth has exploded from an estimated $12,500 during her time as Boston City Councilor in 2018 to a whopping $8 million in 2024, according to Open Secrets. She received a congressional salary of $174,000 per year. According to Presley's financial disclosure report, the congresswoman has listed several homes with estimated values between $1 million and $5 million. Homicide at her Boston home. Presley also spoke on July 18th murder committed at a rental property in Mattapan owned by Harris. A tragedy occurred at a rental property that my husband owns, not our home, Presley said. We are parents to an 18-year-old girl that we just dropped off at college 2 weeks ago. And my heart goes out to this family because that little girl had dreams and they will never become a reality. That is what people should be focused on, grieving with that family and centering that young girl, she continued. The State Office of the Chief Medical Examiner ruled the death of 18-year-old Yuzalani Ann Marte Ocasio a homicide last month. Ocasio was discovered at Presley and Harris's 25 Malta Street address in Mattapan by responding officers with a single gunshot wound. Police officials clarified that the property owners are not involved in the investigation. There is absolutely nothing that indicates any circumstances to the owners of the property, Chief of Internal and External Communications Mary Ellen Burns told the Herald. End of article. Now under the heading of Crime and Public Safety, the police blotter. Middlesex District Attorney is investigating fatal police shooting in Cambridge by Flint McColgan. A man was shot and killed in Cambridge, police officer Friday evening, after they say he pointed a gun at them. Middlesex District Attorney Marion Ryan's office will lead an investigation into the fatal shooting that happened shortly after 8 p.m. on Friday. At that time, the Cambridge Police Department received a call on the business line reporting a suspicious people and activities around the loading dock and parking area behind a business on Temple Street, according to the district attorney's statement. Officers encountered and spoke with multiple people there when, according to the district attorney's statement, a man in his 60s who was seated in a vehicle got out and approached the police with a gun drawn. Police say they attempted to physically disarm him, but were unable to do so, and then multiple shots were fired, striking the individual. The man was treated at the scene, but the man died there. Some officers were treated at area hospitals as a precaution and were released, according to the district attorney. In 2018, the Middlesex District Attorney's Office began the practice of requesting inquest for the fatal incidents. According to an office statement on the matter, an inquest is a judicial proceeding conducted for the purpose of finding the facts and circumstances surrounding a death and determining whether a crime occurred. Moped strikes a cop. Despite police repeatedly ridding city streets of dozens of e-bikes, scooters, and mopeds at a time through regular targeted enforcement efforts, the vehicles still appear to terrorize. Just ask one Boston cop conducting a walk and talk Wednesday afternoon down Franklin Street in Downtown Crossing, a spot designated only for pedestrians and emergency vehicles. The Boston Police Department says that the moped operator mowed right into him rather than stop. The department says this officer, who is unarmed, in their statement saw a moped weaving in and out of pedestrian traffic in an attempt to gain access to Washington Street. When the officer approached to put an end to that, the driver accelerated, knocking the officer to the ground. On Friday evening, police found their suspect traveling at a high rate of speed through the theater district. An officer ran the vehicle plates and found that the operator, Angel Gonzalez, 22, of Dorchester, had an active warrant. The cop pulled over Gonzalez and cuffed him on charges of assault and battery with a dangerous weapon, leaving the scene of personal injury and failure to stop for police. Incident summary. The Boston Police Department responded to 529 incidents in a 48-hour period ending at 10 a.m. on Saturday, according to the department's incident log. Those included 4 robberies, 17 aggravated assaults, 1 commercial burglary, 3 residential burglaries, 4 thefts from vehicles, 2 auto thefts, and 42 instances of miscellaneous larceny. Arrests. All of the below-named defendants are presumed innocent and proven guilty. Jamie Dorsley, 3952 Washington Street, Roslindale, vandalism. Mark Corwell, 44 Maplewood Street, Everett, Mass., disorderly conduct. Anthony Banks, 60 Creston Avenue, Woburn, distribution of Class B drugs. Jose Monteiro, 112 Southampton Street, Roxbury, assault and battery with a dangerous weapon. Sonny Lebarski, no address listed, trespassing. Stephanie Powers, 33688 Washington Street in Jamaica Plain, larceny less than $1,200. Eric Terrell, 1 Lingard Street, Boston, malicious destruction of property valued at more than $1,200. Benjamin Jimenez, 74 Morris Street, Dorchester, strangulation or suffocation. Zotis Hollis, 39 Glenville Avenue, Brighton, assault with a dangerous weapon. Michael Hickey, 309 Tilton Commons, Braintree, larceny from a building. Christian Taylor, 32 Neponset Street, Canton, carrying a firearm without a license. Sandra Beeman, no address listed, external warrant. Olivette Kenner, 330 Rutherford Avenue, Charlestown, external warrant. Carolyn Yule, 94 Reedville Street, Hyde Park, city ordinance violation, drinking of alcoholic beverages in public. Brahia Nichols, 349 Seaver Street, Dorchester, trespassing. Francisco Beltran-Ortiz, 630 Cummins Highway, Boston, unarmed robbery. Victor Delgado Rojas, no address listed, shoplifting, more than $100. Requiem Patterson, 866 Huntington Avenue, Boston, carrying a firearm without a license. Solomon Baxter, 17 Kenilworth Street, Roxbury, assault and battery with a dangerous weapon. Kesia Barita, 568 Blue Hill Avenue, Dorchester, a fray. Sky Grant, 36 Groveland Street, Mattapan, a fray. Viviana Thomas, 1850 Washington Street, Roxbury, a fray. Jawan Wilkins, 26th Avenue, Quincy, external warrant. Nahab Tab, 5 Hummer Rock Way, Hyde Park, distribution of Class B drugs. Calvin White, 112 Southampton Street, Boston, external warrant. Marcus Peterson, 115 Homestead Street, Dorchester, receiving a stolen motor vehicle. Christian Duran Jr., 665 Summer Avenue, Springfield, malicious destruction of property valued more than $1,200. Ada Castro, 48 School Street, trespassing. Tyler Little, 198 Billing Street, Quincy, trespassing. Kelly Martinez Hercules, 40 Breed Street, East Boston, trespassing. Alan Reed, 19 Catbird Court, Mattapan, external warrant. Giovanni Aguiaro, 135 Homestead Street, Washington, failure to stop for police. And that concludes the police blotter for this week. Turning now to sports, the National Football League and the New England Patriots. A gritty performance helps the Patriots hopeful make the case in key position battle. By Greg Dudek. Foxborough. It's been an underwhelming spring for the most part for Patriots backup running back Lan Larison. Larison saw any grip he might have had on the Patriots' third running back spot, which is one of a few position battles taking place this summer, slip in New England's preseason opener last week against the Colts. Given another chance Saturday night against the Philadelphia Eagles that he should hold the position, Larison seized the opportunity. Larison was one of the Patriots' more productive skill players in a narrow 24-21 preseason win over the Eagles at Gillette Stadium. The 2025 undrafted free agent out of UC Davis finished with 9 carries for 33 yards with a rushing touchdown in the fourth quarter and also added 3 receptions for 41 yards. I felt like Land certainly had a good performance, a gritty, tough performance tonight, and did some really good things, Patriots head coach Mike Vrabel said. If Larsen ends up winning the third running back job, he can point to a series in the second half that separated him from the competition. Larsen extended a scoring drive for the Patriots when Vrabel decided to go for it in 4th-and-1 from midfield with 2:10 to go in the third quarter. Larsen backed up his coach's decision by plunging forward for the first down despite being initially greeted by a wall of Eagles defenders. And then, in an obvious passing situation later in the drive, with the Patriots facing 3rd-and-9 from the Eagles' 12-yard line, Larsen was a trusted option again, taking a handoff the left side of it for a 10-yard gain. One play later, Larsen drove into the end zone for a touchdown. It was 4th-and-1, and he gets hit behind the line of scrimmage and finds a way to get the first down, Vrabel said. And then he has another long pass, and then he makes a move, and then he's able to break a couple of tackles there in the third down when we needed it at the end of the game. So he did some good things. Larsen, 24, missed all of last season with a season-ending injury he suffered in the preseason opener and is trying to beat out several other players contending at the same position. It was a step in the right direction for Larsen after he carried the ball 7 times for just 1 yard last week against the Colts. His ability to catch the ball out of the backfield, which he has showed right away on the Patriots' third offensive play by taking a screen pass for 28 yards, might just help him win the position battle. Besides, for one catch from Jamal Hasty, no other running back recorded a reception on Saturday. The other running backs vying for Larsen for a roster spot had solid nights, but didn't have a near standout performance. Jam Miller, a 2026 seventh-round pick out of Alabama, led all running backs with 36 yards rushing on a team-high 11 carries, while Hastings, 5 carries and 12 yards, and Hassan Haskins, 4 carries, 16 yards, didn't make much of a difference, but have experience on their side as NFL veterans. I just got to keep going. It wasn't all just me. It was a line as well and the team, Larsen said. We competed really well, and it was fun. It was a good time, he said. Continuing with the Patriots, Mike Vrabel makes telling admission about the Patriots after the preseason win. By Doug Keed. Fox wrote, don't be surprised if the Patriots rest their starters all preseason. It sounds like head coach Mike Vrabel is concerned about losing any more key players during the exhibition slate. In answering a question about whether Drake May and the rest of the Patriots starters would play in next week's preseason game against the Browns, Vrabel made a revealing concession about his team after Saturday's preseason win over the Eagles. I do not think we have a very deep team, so I think we have to make sure that we are preparing our football team and that we are doing everything that we can to keep our best players available, Vrabel said. And if that means playing Thursday as part of preparation, then that will be what we do. I have not made that decision yet, but I would say that this is something that I am confident in and where we are set up currently. The Patriots have seen 2 key backup offensive linemen go down with injuries in consecutive preseason games. Backup center guard Ben Brown suffered an injury in last week's tie with the Colts that would keep him out for the rest of the preseason. Backup offensive tackle Marcus Bryant suffered an ankle injury in Saturday's win and was quickly ruled out with the injury. I think we just got rolled up on, Vrabel said, on Bryant. I think we will be a lower leg injury, but I do not know to what extent. That is what happens sometimes in these inside plays. So we will have to just take a look and see where he's at. But I will not know anything right now. Patriots running back Trayvon Henderson, rookie tight end Eli Raridan, and safety Kevin Byard all didn't dress for Saturday's game. Vrabel was looking after the game if those were injury situations. I would say that those are individual situations that kept them out of pregame warmups, Vrabel said. Cornerback Christian Gonzalez, outside linebacker Harold Landry, and safety Brennan Schooler are dealing with injuries. Safety Craig Woodson did not finish Thursday's practice against the Eagles and also didn't dress for Saturday's game. The Patriots seemingly still have open competition for their third running back and third linebacker roles. Their depth on the edge with Landry still on the PUP list has also been tested. The Patriots do have a few areas of strong depth at quarterback, wide receiver, and defensive tackle. They also have difficult situations to make on cutdown day at cornerback. End of article. Now turning to Major League Baseball and the Boston Red Sox. The Red Sox stormed back with a wild ninth inning to earn a walk-off win over the Giants by Gabriel Starr. The Red Sox have been an offensive powerhouse this summer, and entering Saturday's leading Major League Baseball in runs, slugging percentage, and OPS, and top of the American League in home runs, batting average, and on-base percentage. Yet between the chilly, misty weather and the Boston bats flailing innings after inning, Saturday felt more like one of their April or May home games than August, a winnable game lost on missed opportunities, until the bottom of the ninth, when the Red Sox again showed the baseball world they are no longer that team. Trailing 2-0, they stormed back to tie and then beat the San Francisco Giants 3-2 on a fielder's choice by RBI by Wheeler Abreu, and Fenway felt and sounded like October. Boston was behind from the very beginning, though Southpaw starter Patrick Sandoval was largely in command during his 5 2/3 innings. Shortstop Willie Adams blasted a 403-foot solo homer to left center at 109.4 miles per hour with two outs in the top of the first. Former AAA Worcester catcher Andrew Kisner doubled the Giants' run total with a leadoff home run in the top of the third. The boos for former fan favorite Rafael Devers carried over from the night before. They were particularly vociferous in the top of the third when the erstwhile Red Sox slugger drew a one-out walk and new catcher Adley Rutschman lost what might be a closest ABS challenge of this inaugural season trying to overturn ball four. The Fenway faithful seemingly transferred their boos from Devers to Sandoval when the starter followed by allowing a single to Adams and bases-loaded walk to Bryce Eldridge, but then flipped the switch to thunderous applause when Sandoval struck out second baseman Osivi Basabe and got right fielder Young Ho Lee to ground out to first to waste the full diamond. The round trippers were the only damage off Sandoval, who allowed 5 total hits, walked 2, and struck out 6 on 93 pitches total. And that's all we have time for today, ladies and gentlemen. Thanks so much for listening, and we hope to see you back here again next week.